Sir was Jennifer Hartman at KUGS. I'm Cody Hoag in Bellingham, Washington. Thank you for listening, and see you next week on Sprouts.
And coming up next on Free Radio, it's the old Bathrob Spears broadsides rolling at you from 6 to 8. Stay tuned. Special focus on the Downtown Commission's Park at Your Peril law, or perhaps it's Walk at Your Peril, the parking lot trespass law, or the parking lot panic law, as I call it, coming up at City Council 5 days from now. Stay tuned.
Busy rising off the Texas plain. Sit and watch the sky, but the clouds are passing by. I'm here in Austin, waiting on that rain. Waiting on that Austin city rain. There ain't a cloud up in the sky. We said our goodbyes, so I still wonder why I'm here in Austin. Waiting on that rain. Well, I grab another taco, phone down another Joe. Siesta time, time to find some shade. I'm lost in Austin, got no place left to go. I'm here in Austin, waiting on that rain. Waiting on that Austin city rain. A cloud up in the sky. We said our goodbyes, so I still wonder why I'm here in Austin, waiting on that rain. Right. Watch another sunset in the dusty west. From La Cantina, house of purple sage. The beer is warm here, but at least it's mostly wet. I'm still in Austin, still waiting on that rain. Waiting on that Austin city rain. There ain't a cloud up in the sky. Said our goodbyes, so I still wonder why I'm here in Austin, waiting on that rain. Yeah, we said our goodbyes, but it's too damn dry to cry. I'm here in Austin, waiting on that rain.
And welcome to Bathrob Spears Broadsides. You're tuned to 101.1 FM, freakradio.org. That was Austin City Rain by, former Santa Cruz street performer Mike True. Mike actually won a piece of change off of the city thanks to the inappropriate false arrest by Sergeant Butchie Lauren Baker about, 6 or 7 years now, something like that. He's... not sure where he is now. I think he's in the Midwest somewhere. But this is a recent CD of his. It's can be reached. You can reach him, I should say, by emailing mstrue1@hotmail.com. That's Mike True. You can check him out if you like his music. He helped start SAFE, Society for Artistic Freedom and Expression, which is a group that performs every Monday, Tuesday, and Wednesday nights. Actually, not a group. It's an idea that a lot of people have picked up to reclaim public space downtown for street performers in the teeth of the Rotkin-Matthews downtown ordinances. I guess we can call them the Coonerty-Riley downtown ordinances now. Riley's the mayor. Coonerty's the vice mayor, soon to be the mayor of Santa Cruz. Anyway, in case you want to comment on this show, anything you hear on this show or you want to get on the show and make a comment or two, you can. It's easy to do. You call 427-3772, 427-FRSC, and I will put you on the air, particularly if you're talking about stuff that we're focusing on. If you're not, I will perhaps be a little less patient, but hey, if you have community news you want to pass on that's relevant, please give us a call. That's what this station is for. It's supposed to be a focal point for people to come together and share what the Sentinel, the Good Times, the Metro, the City on a Hill, KSCO, KZSE, KUSB just aren't interested in, don't have time to share, have no inclination to share, but that you feel is still important to the community. So, I'm going to begin today with a few street interviews and then pretty shortly go into a review of the Downtown Commission's last hearing a week ago, which was all taken up with ratifying and rubber stamping the Coonerty expansion of the, what I call the parking garage paranoia law, and used to call the parking lot panic law. I guess we can call it whatever we want. It's as far as I understand it, though, I haven't checked the agenda yet. This is the word secondhand from Mayor Riley. It will be on the next city council agenda, the first reading of the law that will make it illegal, once passed, to walk into any parking lot anywhere in Santa Cruz, downtown Santa Cruz. It's a public parking lot, unless you have a bicycle or car there, and then only for 15 minutes. In other words, you can't sit in your car and read, or you can for 14 and a half minutes, but you better get your ass out before it becomes a criminal ass, thanks to the Downtown Commission and to, actually, it's the Santa Cruz Police Department and the Public Works that are pushing this. But the real person who's guiding it through is Ryan Coonerty, who's the, worker-in-chief at the Bookshop Santa Cruz. And we'll be out there on Sunday reminding him that he's also not just a private entrepreneur who can be as bigoted in his public statements as he wants, but he's also the mayor, soon to be the mayor, much against our inclination, but that's what usually happens in November. The vice mayor becomes mayor, appointed by the city council. He is right now the vice mayor and the city council, and he's pushing through bad laws and, of course, supporting the sleeping ban. Anyway, here's a little street interviewing. Feel free to call in or to reach me off-air if you'd like, 423-4833. 423-4833 is my off-air number, and we'll take it from there.
Almost 9 o'clock on Sunday night, the 30th of September. We're in front of Borders talking with
Jason
and
Sarah
and
Lucky
and
Last.
Now, there's actually four other people here. You folks are all under 35, I would have to say.
I'm 36.
Oh, almost all. And Jason, what's happened? You say you recently had the Borders came out and offered you all free coffee. What happened?
Yeah. Oh, my. That would be the day.
Extortion.
No, we just had Borders came out and they said that they had a complaint about somebody was asking them for money and they couldn't get in the door. And when the lady came out and clearly saw that there was a whole bunch of musicians around, and we're just hanging out, kicking and socializing.
You're about 20 feet from.
We're over 7 squares from the door.
Over 14 feet from the building.
Yeah, we're clearly
on the corner here of SoCal.
Us. Yes.
And what did she say to you then?
She said, well, okay, I'm not saying that you guys, I haven't gotten too many complaints.
I haven't gotten too many complaints, but
you're doing anything wrong. But I'm just letting you know that I had a complaint. I'm like, well, right on. Well, people, we never ask for money. And we always let people get by, you know?
Well, it's after dark. And in Santa Cruz, if you ask for a dime after dark, it's a crime.
We didn't ask for money. None of us did.
Well, I got my eye on you because, you know, after all, that's
criminal behavior. I have a comment.
Yes, what's your name, sir?
My name is Hugh Clayton Montgomery.
Go ahead, Hugh.
I'm a Vietnam vet. I lost my right elbow in Nam.
Yes.
I'm homeless.
Yeah.
And people are being harassed out here on these streets. Criminals sleeping. Who would ever think of that? That even that word criminal sleeping.
Well, the city council thought of it and made it a law, actually.
Yeah.
Yeah.
May I enter? May I
sleep after 11 o'clock?
We have money to bomb buildings in Arabia. We have money to blow up everything in this planet, but we don't have money to help people.
Now, as a vet, have you been hassled or ticketed in the last week for this?
Yeah, I got the ticket right here.
Show me your ticket. Let's check out this latest example.
It's 3 months old. I just got into the system.
I see. Well, you've got an ancient ticket.
Well, I'll show you.
This is a yellow ticket here.
I'll show it.
See, yeah, number of pieces. This is probably it here.
Okay, wait.
That's my guess. It looks like a citation.
That's it.
So it says here, I would look.
Camping prohibited.
Right.
Correct.
Everything.
Alcoholic.
I had an abscess tooth because I didn't have dental care.
Right.
Possession.
And I had a little bottle of vodka in a grove of poison ivy and oak. And
where was this ticket?
In the Poconips,
uh-huh.
By
Ranger Wallace. Perhaps.
Ranger Wallace. That's it.
What time of the day or night did the ranger come?
In the evening. In the evening.
About what, like late at night or early in the evening?
Yeah, it was when the sun was setting.
I see. And what did the ranger say to you?
He scared the hell out of me.
How so?
I didn't know who he was or what he was. I thought he was like a maniac because the way he just came on me.
Now, were you at a campsite? Or?
A clean campsite, no campfires. It was clean. I'm hiding out because I'm disabled, I'm a vet. And I'm up in the mountains.
Were you alone?
Yes, all alone.
What do you remember what he said to you?
Yeah, he told me, he said, you have no right to camp here. And I had to grovel at his feet. And then he ran my license. Of course, I have no tickets or anything. But anyway, he did that. And I'm facing a $350 ticket. Well, actually, let me show you this. This is what I just got. I got that then. Now, this is 4 months later.
You're pulling out an envelope here.
Yeah, I'm pulling out an envelope.
Let's take a look at this.
All right, take a look at that.
Opening this page up, and it
I just got that last week.
Superior Court.
Yeah, last week.
You decided the following violation. Amount due, $324 by October 24th, 2007.
For a combination of camping ticket, a 6.36C ticket, and a 13.0803.
Which is a consumption of alcohol.
Consumption about. Now, notice, we're not talking about drunkenness. We're talking about consuming. Here's as an adult vet who was not allowed to drink even in his own camp.
I had no insurance at the time. I had an abscess.
Let's be absolutely candid. You sound a little intoxicated now. Am I mistaken? Are you a bit, should we say, buzzed? Wouldn't you?
Yes.
So that being the case, was that the case also when you came up? Not your you. When John came upon you, John Wallace.
No.
You weren't. So tonight, are you claiming you have an abscess tooth again?
No.
Why are you intoxicated?
Because this is a hell of a life to live. I'm 55 friggin' years old. I'm hiding in the bushes. I have no means to. I got Social Security. But either you get an apartment or and not eat, or you live in the bushes and eat.
Now,
so that's what I'm talking about.
Now, this ticket is about 3 or 4 months old, and I frankly tend to be rather sympathetic with your situation, but I'm asking you about the last week. What kind of, have you had any contacts in the last week with the police?
Yes.
And how did those come out? How did the, good or bad?
Move. Bad.
And
move on.
That's a good type of food here. Giving us food.
Move
like
on.
I just
move
ate
on.
A whole bag of food. That is really cool.
You know what? I have to apologize to your viewers or your listeners. I want to make it a very big apology because I'm doing an injustice here. I want to say everything to everybody out there. Look at, there are a lot of people hurting out there.
Right.
There's, we're not all criminals, man. We're human beings. That's all I gotta say.
Any,
don't put this on
you. Hugh, any reports of violence? I'll ask you something. Has anybody had any reports of violence?
Yeah.
There's supposedly someone who likes.
Who am I worried about?
There's violence everywhere.
No, no.
There's reports of attacks on homeless people in the woods.
Yes. Anything you've seen directly or actually?
No, nothing I've seen directly.
Anything you've seen directly, Hugh?
Yes.
What have you seen directly?
I saw somebody get kicked in the ass.
And when was that?
About 5 days ago.
And where was that?
On the railroad tracks on the Poconkeps.
About what time of day?
3 o'clock.
And who did it?
I don't know who they did it to, but they kicked him in the bum so bad he was bleeding.
How far away were you from this incident?
100 feet.
And how did you happen to be there? Do you know the guy?
I saw what was going on.
One assailant or more than one?
There's two.
And do you hear anything, any conversation that went on?
Well, I know what goes on up there. Let me just say this.
Before you explain, because I'm trying to kind of get to the facts of this.
There's violence up there. Nobody has nowhere else to go.
I understand.
We have nowhere else to live.
I'm looking for documentation.
So we're living in violence.
Yes. I'm looking for documentation of specific incidents that happened.
All right. I'm not going.
So if you understand,
I don't know.
No problem. And I appreciate that. And so if anybody gets any more details, I want to know about it. I expect a full report. We've been talking with
last
L-A-S-T, save
the best for last.
There you go. All right, then. Your name is?
Sarah.
What'd you see, Sarah?
Nothing. Just go down to Lighthouse Beach, and there's a lot of people who follow the rumors and stuff like that.
Okay, maybe I may do that. And you, and something about somebody hanging that you either saw?
I've never seen nothing.
Anybody?
No.
Okay. Well, there we have it.
It's all good. But, you know, help the homeless, man.
Right on. So.
And that is something I'm really looking for information on, even though we have... Looks like mainly an intoxicated guy down in front of Borders and some folks who don't know too much. There have been a lot of rumors about stories and real fear circulating around about violence in the Poconkeps, people being killed up there, no camping, being carved on people's bodies. And I pass on these rumors not because I think they're true or because I have any evidence of them, because they disturb me. And I'm looking to get either verification of any kind of violence is happening up there. So if anybody knows about this, please give a call to this radio show. You can call on air if you want, 427-3772. Or you can call my off-air, voicemail, and you sometimes might even catch up with me at 423-4833, 423-HUFF, H-U-F-F. HUFF is also Homeless United for Friendship and Freedom, which meets every Wednesday. We met yesterday. At the county building. And if you want more information about HUFF, you can go online to huffsantacruz.org. In fact, that's where these radio shows are archived, in case you want to review them or amuse yourself with the history of what's been cooking the last few years from at least one perspective, mine and that of the people I interview. Here's a few more interviews, then we'll proceed to the Downtown Commission. The deadly Downtown Commission hearings of last week and the parking lot panic law.
Well, we're back here at 910 at the front of New Leaf Market. Officer Brandt has parked his car on the street. So what happened with Officer Brandt as he's wandered through the area?
Oh, no, he had a complaint.
What was the nature of the complaint?
Drunk and disorderly. It was actually confusion because two guys just came through here and beat up a rack over there.
No, they
beat up the rack.
Oh, they beat on the rack?
Yeah, but probably whoever called and complained, the two guys were probably here when they called and complained.
They thought it was this group, and Officer Brandt is appropriately moving on. Good for him. Well, I've got no objection to that. Do we have a group here, and this is a different group than the conversation a moment ago, of about 15 people, including Suzanne with drums, and a fellow with a guitar, and another folks hanging out, a guy with a skateboard, and who knows what else, man. In the area where there's usually chairs in the afternoon with alfrescos and Cafe Campesino people supping and munching and crunching. Okay, well, it's about 2 o'clock or a little bit before, and I'm here on the west side talking with a man who has a T-shirt in honor of a homeless guy who just died. Front of the T-shirt says, Vets for Free Fishing, and the back says...
Memories and best wishes for Carl Stevens.
Now, who was Carl Stevens?
Carl Stevens was a dear friend for at least 20 years here on the west side of Santa Cruz.
He lived outside?
Wherever he laid his hat, kind of, I suppose. He was traveling all the time. He was from Florida to California once a year. But my hopes are that we all just remember, and the ones that knew him well remember his spirit and the love that we all had for him. And it's a sad thing when someone leaves, but sometimes it's what it takes to bring people closer together, and that's what's obvious right now. And so in the next month on the west side here, there'll be my friends and thoughts of the times that we shared with him.
And you're going to actually have a memorial service coming up on the Sunday after next, the 14th?
Yes, that'll be it. Most likely, I can't say for sure, but most likely at the Circle Church here on the west side.
And you, the front of the T-shirt you made for him, and you had this T-shirt especially made, Vets for yourself, to remember him, Vets for Free Fishing. What does, explain that to us. Why would he have wanted that?
Well, that was his his passion and his dream, and he... He would say it best. I couldn't say it.
There's a charge for fishing unless you're a vet or something like that?
Well, his understanding basically is if we're going to go to war, put our lives up to defend the country, and we come home, the least that we as veterans should be able to do is fish for free. And he had a passion about that, and I think it was generally just a lack of responsibility that he felt that the United States showed their veterans of war. And he enjoyed the idea of communicating and expressing the needs that we all need to share together. And some of those needs were veterans that are out there a little bit handicapped in a sense that they need to go on every day just like all of us, and I think it's obvious that they need more understanding than most.
Well, I know that there's some kind of provision for vets, for example, vending in Santa Cruz. You don't need a special vending license if you're a vet, is what I've heard, although I've never really investigated that particular law. Currently, then, it costs money for a vet to get a fishing license, and Carl's concern and your concern, and we're talking with Steve, right? What's your name?
My name's Scotty.
Scotty. I knew it started with an S. I was close, but so Scotty, that's your concern too, that vets not have to pay for fishing licenses, right?
You know, I wasn't driven in that direction, but the whole idea of campaigning always brings hope for a better tomorrow.
Okay. Any final words for this man who, I guess he was killed recently, right? And the man who killed him is now in custody?
Yeah, he's here in Santa Cruz, and he'll be going to court, I guess, on the first week of October in San Mateo. Any thoughts just in general for me is it's been a brand new reunion for the Santa Cruz earthquake coming up, and that'll be on 17th of October. And we always like to help people remember the awesome powers that can change our lives any minute.
Thank you, Scotty.
Thank you, huh?
Thank you, sir.
Yeah, we did, but I heard about it. It's fabulous.
Oh, really? It's 5:40 downtown on Pacific Avenue, Monday, the February 2nd. There's a march coming up the sidewalk, and the looks like the SEIU, in their courageous fashion, a lot of signs, SEIU, no contract, no work. But they are oh so well behaved. They are on the sidewalk, so they're not, they're passing badass coffee now. And continuing, how about taking to the streets, guys? I guess they're pretty too well behaved here. There's Tim Fitzmaurice. He's with his sign. Oh, they're giving a nice little march. And it includes a city worker. Fair retirement now, no contract, no work. It's a very well-behaved march, but it does last all of a long block and has many, many purple shirts included. Looks like there are a few monitors walking on the streets, but generally everything is very well-behaved, and they are on the sidewalk. You can hear the chants. Service Employees Union International.
Wow.
This is the county, it's not just the city workers, actually.
Wow.
Nice. These are the same city workers, of course, that threw homeless people out of the parking lots. It's kind of ironic, isn't it?
Yeah.
But, I mean, I support them. I think they should have
it. Yeah, I get you.
Take to the streets! The streets!
Not no obstruction traffic.
But they don't seem to want to. The streets! Take the streets! Don't you deserve the street? No, apparently not.
Well, they planned it.
I know. It's all very well planned. It's all very nice, and then they go home. How sweet.
Yeah.
Kind of like the protesters against the war. They've still got a war on. What's your name?
Yutaka.
And you took out, show me your solo station. You got a small clipboard here. Donation funds for world peace and youth programs. Fondos para los niños pobres.
And
languages.
Vietnamese.
And it looks like you got this is
Chinese.
This is
Korea.
And this is
Vietnamese.
And you yourself are of what extraction? Where are you from?
Oh, Japan.
You are from Japan.
Yeah.
Well, there's no Japanese translation on here. Now, why not?
No.
Well, what's going on here? Oh,
over the world.
You are continuing. Where's the Japanese translation? We see a Korean translation.
Yeah.
We see a Chinese translation.
Yeah.
But do we see a Japanese translation?
Yeah.
Where?
In Mexico. In Africa.
You're showing me pictures, but I don't see any translation. This is the translation. The words. Well, actually, I'm being a little pickier. So what kind of a charity are you trying to... Just for example, Reverend Moon's Unification Church?
Yeah.
That's what I thought. How is the Reverend doing these days?
Huh?
How is he doing? How is Reverend Moon?
Yeah.
How is he good?
Reverend is good.
He's great. Now, have you met the Reverend yourself?
Yeah.
When did you meet him?
Unification Church.
When did you meet him? Did you meet him? Have you seen him? Have you had a drink together, you know?
No.
Now, how many hours a day do you work doing this?
1 month.
But how many hours a day?
10 hours.
10 hours a day. And when you sleep at night, where do you sleep? You sleep inside a house, a dormitory?
A house. Yeah.
How many people sleep in that house?
Ten people.
In Santa Cruz?
Yeah.
And are there, they're all...
Santa Cruz, no, San Jose.
In San Jose.
Yeah.
So you're here for the day.
Yeah.
And you go back to San Jose.
Yeah.
Now, what's your average amount of money you make per day?
I don't know.
No? I mean, do you make $100, $5?
Me?
No, for the church.
Oh. $200.
Yeah. So $200 a day, 10 hours a day, $20 an hour.
Yeah.
Okay. And how are people? Hey, Shannon, long time no see. How long? Again, your name is?
Gang.
Gang. I'm Robert Gang. Anything you want to say to the folks out there on behalf of the Reverend Moon?
Mm.
You want to say something to the radio people?
Samuel Moon is good.
He's good.
Yeah,
okay.
He's good. Thank you.
You're a supporter of the Reverend Moon. Well, thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
All right.
I don't know. Folks can learn more about the Unification Church and Reverend Moon probably by Googling for Reverend Moon. He was more famous in the late 60s and early 70s, notorious for brainwashing people and kind of massive slave labor kind of charity fundraising activity for extreme right-wing causes. It's kind of interesting to find a Mooney on the streets in Santa Cruz in 2007, but perhaps not. I think Moon's probably gotten more powerful rather than less. Anyway, you're tuned to Free Radio, 101.1 FM, freakradio.org. Here's a little here's a couple of updates. We talked about the death, well, Scotty talked about the death of Carl Stevens, who I didn't know, who was murdered apparently recently, I think by somebody who was picked up in Half Moon Bay. And there was a memorial for him, Carl Stevens, 14th Sunday after next at the Circle Church, which is, I guess, at Arrett Circle. Not sure when. Maybe if I get more information, I can pass that on. The day before that, at 701 Ocean Street at the courthouse, there is another memorial for somebody I do know of, or did know. I don't want to say I knew him quite well, but we knew each other professionally a lot. We were friends. We went out together. Richard Quigley is the guy I'm talking about. And he was an activist who fought for a lot of things. He's most famous for his defending the right to choose your own kind of helmet if you're a motorcycle rider, or no helmet at all. Your right to be free from police harassment if you are simply using the public spaces in a way that might not please merchants and business interests and first alarm security guards who happen to be patrolling the area, but that is in fact perfectly appropriate, legal, and constitutional. And he spent a long time defending Jerry Henry, who's a long time minister to young people, who is still, I believe, banned from the coffee roasting company in Aptos and still fighting a court case, a 10-year-old court case on that issue. Anyway, Quigley has a memorial. It's coming up on the Saturday, October 13th, 1 p.m. on the steps of the county building, or actually it's probably going to be on the steps of the courthouse. So he was so often there at 701 Ocean Street. Now, if I'm in town, I will probably be there. And there's a new article about Richard Quigley in the City on a Hill Press Primer. That's a kind of a big, thick newspaper size but slick publication. You can get it in the Logos bookstore, which comes out once a year, I think, whenever the UCSC begins its term, its fall term. And there's a long article on Richard Quigley and his motorcycle helmet struggle. It sounds a little quixotic. I mean, who gives a shit whether you have to wear a helmet or not? But the idea that police officers can stop you, harass you, ticket you, and actually brutalize you if you aren't following their orders just because you're choosing your own kind of headgear on a motorcycle, crossed the line with Richard. He believed it was a principle. And he went so far as to successfully argue it before local judges, and to get local judges to declare that essentially the way that the law is written, there is no standard for helmets that can be uniformly and reasonably enforced. and therefore they're not supposed to be enforcing it at all. And that's still being fought out in the courts even after Richard's death. I think attorney Kate Wells or other attorneys are following up on it. And it's something you can learn more about by Googling for Richard Quigley. He also did a lot of shows which of his own on radio station KSCO. In fact, I believe one of his major achievements, if you want to talk about something that's a little more mainstream, he would be critical of certain police deputies, certain sheriff's deputies, and particularly the upper management under Mark Tracy. And I think he became more critical of Sheriff Robbins, who's the current head sheriff of Santa Cruz County. And he was once, he would give a weekly broadcast at radio station KSCO, some of which are still archived, either at the KSCO website or at Quigley's own website, which is just Google for Richard Quigley, and I hope the website is still up. I'm hoping Kate Wells and other friends of his continuing to maintain it. People came, well, not people, a deputy came to his station, sent by then Sheriff Tracy to, in essence, warn the management of the station that they risked being subject to sanctions and penalties from the Sheriff's Department if they allowed Quigley to continue his critical broadcasts exposing abuses in the Sheriff's Office, the Sheriff's Department, and criticizing by name and by specific activity certain officers, which is what I do here on Free Radio. But this was, of course, on a much bigger radio station that had a much wider coverage. And the result was that Quigley filed a lawsuit against the Sheriff's Office that KSCO manager or owner Michael Zwirling, in a cowardly fashion, took Quigley off the air, claiming it was a legal dispute. And Quigley, in essence, won the lawsuit. It never went to court. It was settled. Tracy resigned. You really didn't get much high-profile publicity about that, but Quigley's action had a significant impact on provoking that resignation. Although we now, of course, have to pay Tracy's huge retirement benefits. Anyway, his memorial is the 13th, Saturday, 1 p.m., steps of the county building. And there's been another death, too, the death of John Berendon. John was a Homies for the Homeless activist who slept at City Hall, helped to create the safe zone that Mayor Riley and Vice Mayor Coonerty refused to create. Tonight there's legal, safe sleeping spots for emergency walk-in for no more than 40 homeless people out of a population of 1,500 to 2,000. The rest have got to find their own campsites, campgrounds, places to hide, places to sleep. Well, Homies for the Homeless created such a place at City Hall for 6 nights. And for 6 nights, people were safe there. Some people got tickets. The first night, 2 people got tickets. The last night, when they drove people away, 4 people got tickets. And we're actually going to hear a little tape about that, too. Maybe I'll play that next before we return to the deadly downtown commission. Anyway, John Berendon, who I'll probably play some tape from on Sunday, and I think I've already played some of him, he was the first person approached by the police on Monday morning, August 13th, after 30 or 40 people had slept out overnight at City Hall, peacefully and legally, actually, because even though it's against the city's ordinance, the city's sleeping ban law, which says you can't sleep after 11 o'clock at night on any public property whatsoever, or in a vehicle of your own, legally parked, even though it was against that law, it was, in fact, constitutionally right, considering the court decision of the federal Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals, which ruled in a case out of Los Angeles, Jones versus City of L.A., that L.A. can't enforce laws that criminalize people for sleeping at night unless they have places for people to go. And since it's obvious that they don't, the enforcement of that law in the Skid Row area was enjoined, prevented, stopped. Probably not entirely, because the courts don't keep a close eye on the police, and the police are using other means to harass the homeless down there. But the idea that you can make sleep a crime at night when you have no place for people to go was thrown out in the Jones decision, and not just in Los Angeles, but in 9 states. And it was thrown out, however, only in that particular case, and therefore other cases have to work their way up there for that to be fully realized, except that some cities got the word and saw what was happening and took initial preventive action so they wouldn't be sued. San Diego, Richmond, and Fresno. The one city that didn't, of course, is Santa Cruz, because we know we're a progressive city, and we would never be sued because, well, our homeless activists are so ineffective in getting together, they couldn't do it, and people are too interested in, you know, purchasing frou-frou and knickknacks and, I don't know, pursuing environmental concerns about non-human aspects of the environment. And the homeless part of the environment is not considered to be terribly important in this regard by those who are pretty well-funded in this area. But nonetheless, this homeless for the homeless was set up. They set up their campsite, and the first person they approached, as I said before, was John Berendon. John's a 60-year-old vet, or was, and we gave some seminars and some suggestions as to how to deal with the police. And John, when he was approached by, I guess it was Sergeant Harms and the officer with him, he said, first of all, can I go back to sleep? In other words, asking him, is this a voluntary interaction? Are you requiring us to talk? And he said, no, you can't. It's illegal to sleep here. And he said, well, where can I go? Give me a legal place to go to sleep then. And the officer said, what do you mean, personally? And he said, no. Well, what do you mean, personally? You're not here personally to give me a ticket. You're here professionally. And the police sees these kinds of dodges, you know, as though, you know, they suddenly shift from their role with the badge and the gun and the law book that drives you out of town to, oh, he's just a nice guy. He's just doing his job. And, gee, gosh, I wish he weren't doing it, that sort of thing. But that's all very well. He does what he does, whether he's wearing one coat or the other. And Berendon saw that very clearly and spoke up very strongly. And he said, well, give me a ticket if that's what you're going to do. And the cops looked at him and said, I will come back to you. But they never did, because they didn't want to deal with that. He mentioned he was a vet. He felt he had a right to sleep legally somewhere, not necessarily anywhere and everywhere, but somewhere. And they actually gave a ticket to another vet who was sleeping next to the door to Riley's office, a guy named Happy, and they gave a ticket to Bajani Romero, who's been around town for quite a while and has slept out on many a night and will probably be a plaintiff in the sleeping ban lawsuit that we're trying to do here to duplicate what Los Angeles did in overturning their sleeping ban. Anyway, I received word that John Berendon died about 5 days ago. He was found dead Sunday morning. He actually had gotten work. He had gotten a place to stay in Monterey, where he was spending a lot of time. His companion, Ben, passed on the word that he had he died of a heart attack. Not a drug overdose, you know, but a heart attack. And I just wanted to mention it because I was impressed with John, and I really am sorry to see him go. He came back to Santa Cruz specially to come to meetings to help organize and support other homeless people who are being threatened and intimidated by Coonerty's sleeping ban, Riley's police force. And I use these names specifically, even though Riley and Coonerty, the mayor and the vice mayor specifically, don't actually have direct control over the police department. But they have significant control over these laws. They could take action, they could raise their voices, and they don't. In fact, they act in the opposite direction to feed the prejudices and support the bigotry of those who live indoors who should know better around these issues. You're tuned to Free Radio, 101.1 FM, freakradio.org. I'm Robert Norse. This is Bathrop's Pierre's Broadsides. A couple more comments about John, and he actually gave this as part of an interview. Maybe I can find the interview and play it. But he said that he actually went over to the bookshop Santa Cruz, where we're doing a weekly protest. We weren't there the last 2 weeks, but we'll be back on Sunday on the sidewalk in front of the bookshop, which is what Vice Mayor Ryan Coonerty is the chief worker there. His father owns the store, and it masquerades as a progressive bookstore in a town that is all and nothing, not at all progressive toward homeless people. And he went in to try to find out what was going on with the bathrooms, because there was a rumor that Ryan Coonerty was going to close the bathrooms because they've been vandalized, and he wanted to. He blamed that indirectly on the protesters. He said, you know, they're making it seem it's some sort of political action to vandalize the bathrooms. And the management later said that, well, manager people I talked to, a woman named Clydia, I believe, and that was the person I emailed back and forth, and we also had a conversation, that there had been an upsurge in bathroom vandalism. The Bookshop Santa Cruz has a bathroom and has had for about 25 or 30 years that it's kept open for the public, even non-customers. And I've always commended them for this, and I've appreciated this, and I think we all should appreciate this. I don't think we should vandalize their bathrooms. It's really quite simple. It's not. It's counterproductive. It's stupid. You know, it's not a good thing to do. So we obviously don't support it. And yet Coonerty was going to use it to try to discredit us, to claim that we were behind it, that what we were doing was encouraging it. And so he banned two activists, Bernard Klitzner and Becky Johnson. I've been banned for years from that store because 13 years ago when it was under the more direct management of supervisor and previously mayor Neil Coonerty, Ryan Coonerty's father, I led protests in front of the bookshop that directly demanded that held Coonerty responsible for this whole set of downtown ordinances that we now suffer under, which, in addition to the sleeping ban laws, it says you can't sit within 14 feet of a building. Then it was 6 feet of a building. Actually, initially it was you couldn't sit on any sidewalk. Coonerty wanted to put in panhandling permits. He made it illegal to ask for a dime after dark, even in a peaceful way. His laws had all kinds of other nasty ramifications, and after our protest back in 1994, somebody, the next day, somebody threw a rock through one of his windows, and he then banned me, and I've been banned for the last 13 years. I had nothing to do with it. I don't support it. Stupid move. But, you know, Coonerty kind of shows, as did Ryan, his son, showed what they were really, the kind of political solutions they have for problems, which is to punitively go after constitutional rights in order to serve what they regard as a social or a security purpose. In my case, it was, he was going to punish me and other activists for speaking out because that speaking out might have made someone else angry somewhere down the line when they saw Coonerty was removing rights from the community and from individuals, and took action which. Again, vandalism is, generally speaking, not such a hot idea. You know, it doesn't not particularly effective. Now, rioting, on the other hand, I don't know. I mean, it's a real issue. I'm actually going to read you from a book called Nonviolence Protects the State, if I have any time later this evening, to open up a discussion on the issue of nonviolence, which I think is an important issue. I myself am pretty thoroughly nonviolent. I mean, I'm, not much of a weapons man. I don't know much about self-defense even. And I'm, I believe in raising issues verbally and in writing. That's what I do. And on the radio. Anyway, John Barrenden went to the bookshop, checked out the bathrooms because he didn't like vandalism there either. He found that they weren't going to close the bathrooms, and though there had been some vandalism, it's not clear. There always has been some vandalism in Bookshop Santa Cruz's bathrooms, according to what I understand. But it's been claimed there's been more vandalism after our protests during that period of time in the last couple months when we've been there. And it could well be. I'm not saying it isn't true. He did say, however, that he himself was banned from the Bookshop Santa Cruz. And I said, how did that happen? And he said, well, He fell asleep in a chair there, and he was also a patron of the bookshop. He said he'd bought many books, and somebody came up and said, you can't sleep here. Wake up. You're going to have to get out. This isn't a bedroom and so forth. And apparently the woman put it in such a harsh way that he said to her as he left, I just thank God I'm not you, at which point she started screaming and said, according to John, this stupid-ass person, everybody look at him. He is banned for life. And I guess we can't blame Ryan Coonerty for that because he didn't do it. But On the other hand, I didn't hear that he had vetoed that either. Anyway, that was John Barrington, dead at 60. Thanks for your help, John. A couple of quick announcements before we turn to the drone of the Downtown Commission. There's a Good Times article today. I don't mean article. There's a letter in the Good Times today that I wrote that talks about the sleeping ban, and it refers to stuff that the Good Times did last week in a column called The Ticker, which I talked about a week ago. The Good Times, in essence, kind of suggested homeless activists were behind vandalism at City Hall, and I said, oh, yeah? Okay, well, show me your evidence. And they said, oh, well, no, we didn't really mean that. And I said, well, then take it back, make a public statement. But I couldn't get Peter Cott, who wrote the article, or Greg Archer, the editor of the Good Times, to do that. So the best they would do is they would include a letter, which they did. And the letter is in the Good Times today, and you can check it out if you want. I wrote it, and I'll read it at some point for those of you who don't read or are too nauseated by the Good Times advertising to pick one up or banned from every store in town. It's a free paper, so it's not hard to find. A couple of quick announcements. Students Against War is meeting on campus 5 to 7 tomorrow at the Bay Tree Conference Center. I've always had this fantasy of some sort of alliance between Students Against War and HUF, Homeless United for Friendship and Freedom, because we have a thing called the Vigil Against Two Wars, where we try to publicize the local failings and support of bad federal policies that our local politicians like Emily Riley or John Laird or Representative Farr do, and encourage people to oppose them. And that, you know, that can range from John Laird's recent vote to make Iran a terrorist nation and disinvest in it until it was no longer a, quote, terrorist nation, according to the State Department. That was passed by the State Assembly a month or two ago. And actually, the Good Times printed my letter on that subject, strangely enough. I actually gotten two letters in the Good Times this year. And I wrote Laird about it and asked him why he did it, and I got no answer whatsoever from Representative and former Mayor John Laird, or Lord Laird, as I used to call him. Laird has, in many respects, done good things for upper-middle-class folks, maybe for all of us, too, in terms of his fight against homophobia. John's gay, I believe, and he's sponsored some good legislation in that regard. But I have to hold him to account for his abusive behavior toward homeless people when he was mayor and his failure to stand up to the Democratic Party hacks. Now that he's in the assembly, and he votes along with them, in essence helping this push toward war with Iran. Students Against War hopefully will be doing something about this, maybe even coming off the hill down into Santa Cruz. What a concept. Check them out, 5 to 7 at the Bay Tree Bookstore, or the Bay Tree Conference Center, actually, probably across from the bookstore on campus. Coming up also on Monday at 6 o'clock, at City Hall, I mentioned this before, the Measure K Commission will have one of its meetings, its second meeting, actually, or maybe if you really want to be technical, its third, though the first one lasted for all of a minute and a half. Almost literally, that's true. Measure K Commission is a commission that looks into supposedly making sure that Santa Cruz Police Department follows the initiative voted by the voters last fall in making marijuana prosecutions the lowest enforcement priority. Since the commission has been emasculated by a lawsuit from the Riley Coonerty City Council, I should say the Wilson Barrisoni City Council. Dick Wilson is the manager. John Barrisoni is the city attorney, and they seem to have much more power. Their agenda seems to be what rules in a lot of significant matters at the city council. Measure K Commission meets. Anita Henry is asking people to come. That's 6 o'clock on Monday. Mark it on your calendar. City Council Chambers. Check it out. Let's hold our nose and listen to the Downtown Commission's hearing a week ago on the parking lot panic law, which is going to make it illegal for Food Not Bombs to serve food in the parking lot adjacent to the farmer's market, illegal to have a drum circle there, illegal for you to sit in your car in any of the downtown parking lots for more than 15 minutes, and make it give the police an additional basis for and pretext for harassing you if they see you lingering in any parking lot. Although the best thing to do is to say, "Officer, I have nothing to say to you. If you want to give me a ticket, please do. We can take it up as a false arrest," because they have to prove beyond a reasonable doubt that you are there not parking a car or vehicle. And how the hell do they know if the cars or bicycles in that parking lot are yours or not? Just don't argue with them. Don't just say, "Officer, do your thing." Of course, what they'll do is they'll look at you sternly and say, "I'll be back in 15 minutes," and they'll... Because even after 15 minutes, even with your car or bicycle, you're not allowed to park. You're not allowed to be there. I suppose if you went out and then parked again, it's a real ridiculous scene, the idea that suddenly you're going to remove vast amounts of public space because some merchants have the idea it's going to make the town safer and more appealing. I guess they want to eliminate events in the parking lots, like square dancing events, which the Free School was throwing, like the... Trash Orchestra, which marched through the garage lot, although they did that illegally, on their way to the Mime Troupe about a week and a half ago on that Sunday afternoon when they assembled and marched down Pacific Avenue. They took to the streets, unlike the SEIU. Apparently the Trash Orchestra has more courage than the SEIU, which has hundreds of members. The SEIU is more concerned with... This shows you the death, why unions are dying, I guess, because they don't have the willingness to be truly militant anymore, but that's a whole different subject. Downtown Commission, and I play this because it's coming up at City Council, and we need to have this record for people to refer to, and when I make this tape, it will be on an audio file that people can then download and listen to. So we're going to be joining the Downtown Commission. Some of this has already been played. Go back to my prior show if you want to hear it, last Sunday and before that last Thursday. But that's only the beginning of it. We're going to be tuning in where Zach Friend, this is in a room, about 40 or 50 people are in the room. The Downtown Commission is meeting. It's about 8:45 in the morning on Thursday, last Thursday, September 28th. And the only thing on the agenda is the parking lot expansion law. That is to say, expanding, making it illegal to have any public assemblies or to even enter into a parking lot at all unless you have a car or bicycle. And this is Zach Friend's discussion of why this is a good law. And again, this was voted down by the Downtown Commission previously, about 2 months before, because the police presented absolutely no statistics to show why this should happen. This time they came with statistics in five parking lots, arrests, that in essence showed about one or two arrests per month as the crime wave that needed to be addressed in the parking lots. In fact, most of the arrests, the highest crime record was in the parking lot area where police currently have made it illegal to be. Lot number 9 across from the homeless meal on Elm Street between Pacific and Cedar Street, right near the back of the Catalyst there. So this may indicate to the naive, or possibly to the far-seeing, that when you make it illegal, you give the police more opportunity to write citations, more opportunity to exercise their powers, more opportunity to police, particularly if their policing doesn't involve, serious investigative work, the risk of physical injury, if it simply involves hassling people who are poor and who look different, and therefore you have a license to go after them. Because this is exactly what the police do during every meal at Elm Street. Their squad car parks in that lot, and they treat it like their personal preserve. It's a sort of a disgusting situation. And it also forces everybody who had previously been able to take the food, go across the street and sit in the parking lot in the empty places or on the edges and eat there. They can't do that. That's illegal. Now they have to all cram onto the sidewalk. That's what's going to happen in all the other 19 parking lots once this law passes next Tuesday, if it passes. You're tuned to Free Radio, 101.1 FM, freakradio.org. I'm Robert Norse. This is Bathrop's Piers Broadsides, and this is the Downtown Commission.
What
the back flipping man who's turned into a songster.
No, this is not the Downtown Commission, but this, if I get my tape recorders right, is the Downtown Commission.
Friend, Santa Cruz Police Department, I've got what I provided here was just a sampling of five of the downtown parking lots and the criminal arrest and citation and field interview information from them. Last year when this was brought forth to you, there was questions about what calls for service data exactly meant. People felt, what does suspicious circumstances mean? When someone calls the police or they call dispatch and they say, there's someone who maybe is standing outside of a vehicle, they think that they might be out to do something, that may be coded as a suspicious circumstance. It's a call for service. We get there and we find out it's totally different. But when you just read pure calls for service data, that's what it says. It's very unclear. So I thought what might be better for you was with actionable items by the police department. These are situations where we actually arrested somebody, we actually cited somebody. In other words, we witnessed all these things happening, the actual crimes. These numbers are significantly lower than the calls for service that the police department received in these lots, but they're tangible items. So what's broken down in front of you are just quite simply the top four types in each one. That's why the numbers don't add up to the numbers below. The number below, where you see total, is the total numbers of arrests, citations, or field interviews in those actual parking lots. The four above are the top four reoccurring. I mean, there are dozens upon dozens in each lot. I didn't want to do a multiple-page spreadsheet to show you each one where there are a number of occurrences that just happened one time. That's the explanation of why there's four. And I'd be happy to answer any specific questions about these types of crimes. You will notice that there are very... there are reoccurring crimes, be it alcohol-related, which is drunk in public, or maybe it's a open container citation. Warrants and parole violations are just what you'd think there would be. People who had an outstanding warrant that was spotted by a downtown officer, or there's a parole violation either being where they are or they have a parole violation in general. Those can be for both, can be for very serious crimes and not serious crimes. There's thefts and grand thefts, which you would expect in parking lots, a lot of vehicle burglaries, a lot of things stolen, especially once things are purchased from downtown businesses. We find that people do get their cars broken into if they leave at invisible locations. And the most unfortunate are some of the serious crimes, like assaults with deadly weapons and batteries, which we found in some of these lots that occurred within the last year and a half.
So, it's hard for you to understand this, unless you can actually look at their little spreadsheet, which you can do by going to indybay.org/Santa Cruz, indybay.org/Santa Cruz, I-N-D-Y-B-A-Y, IndyBay. And what you find is they've gotten together stats for four parking lots for a period of, it's actually a year and a half, so that's 18 months. And in 18 months, there were four resisting arrests, four vehicle burglaries, 11 warrant parole violations, and 18 alcohol-related citations or arrests. And then there were about 29, 30, about 60 more unidentified police arrests or citations at that parking lot address. Now, Don Zimmerman of the ACLU wrote a letter to Zach Friend asking, well, how do you know that these actual activities happened inside the parking lots and were related to them and weren't, let's say, on the edges by, you know, on the sidewalk or nearby, or they just used that address? And Zach Friend did not answer that. So we don't quite know that. But we do know that if you look, if you divide 101, which is the largest number of citations and arrests of the four, they actually mentioned five parking lots, of the four parking lots that aren't currently covered with a law that bans you from entering them unless you've got a car or bicycle. If you look at those four lots, and you look at that one lot, you've got 101 crimes that supposedly happened in those parking lots for which there were arrests or citations. These aren't convictions, they're just citations, arrests. Or arrests. So that's to be considered, too. But even considering that, we're talking about over a period of 18 months. So that means if it were over 20 months and you had 100 crimes, it would be every month we're talking about, what, five crimes? Something like that. So we're talking about five citations or arrests per month. And the worst, or the one that they typify as the worst lot, and that includes things like alcohol-related. And, you know, you get people get cited for alcohol when they come out of bars and they're drunk. I mean, and a lot of them probably don't, but some of them do. In fact, that's the largest category in the front and Cathcart lot number 7, which the police cite. As I said, ironically, the largest number of crimes, that is to say, arrests and citations. I don't want to say crimes, because people, we don't have conviction records. When asked about that, Zach Friend said, oh, we don't have conviction records. Of course, they could obviously get them. There wouldn't be a problem with that. But they didn't. And that's something people should demand when this comes before the city council. Because the question really here, again, is really this very, very important broad question, which was considered last year when they passed that and made all garages criminal zones. You're a criminal if you walk into a garage without there being a car or bike with you. How many innocent activities, how many productive activities, how many ordinary, everyday, average activities are now banned because of this law? And what are we losing? I mean, a civil libertarian will tell you, you know, get the fuck out of my life. Stay off of my person, my property, my civil rights. But even if you don't use that argument, if you just ask, let's look at the social utility here. What are you destroying and denying and shutting off by, you know, in the name of public safety, where, again, the issue is it really safer when no one is around? You know, I mean, that's another issue. But there was no real investigation of that issue. And also there was no real investigation of alternatives. In other words, they didn't find there were any rapes in any of these parking garages in the year prior to the 2005-2006 there when they passed this law. And there's no mention of rapes in the parking lots either. Or there's and how many assaults? Well, I look at this and I find two assaults and armed robbery in Front and Laurel Street, and two breaking and assault with a firearm on Cedar and Lincoln, again, over a period of 18 months. And the real question is, how does this compare with the rest of the downtown area? How does this compare with other areas in town? I mean, how significant a crime problem is it? Why don't we simply start making it a crime to loiter anywhere in town if this is such a good approach? Let's make it illegal to be there unless you have a card or a legitimate purpose or money or a vehicle. And, of course, that would be unconstitutional, wouldn't it? And Brian Kennedy would say, well, you know, parking lots are not public forum. And you're going to hear him say this on Tuesday if you go to the 3 o'clock session, which is where this whole thing is going to be discussed at Santa Cruz City Council. But, you know, this is not, it's not the same thing, you see, because these aren't really public forums because, you know, they're just parking lots. That's all they are. But in Santa Cruz, parking lots are part of the public space downtown. They're not some private corporate preserve that you have to, you know, show ID to get into. But now they will be, in the sense that you won't be able to go there unless you have a car or bicycle, or unless you're directly walking across without stopping. Don't stop to help somebody, you know. Don't pause to chat and say hi to a friend. That's illegal. And the point has also been made, well, there have only been two citations issued in the garages in the last year, which to me is a sad thing that people have not resisted these laws. I always walk through the garages. I always try to hang out in the garages because I feel it is inappropriate for me to surrender my civil rights and to surrender my normal way of dealing with things in Santa Cruz, to treat myself like a criminal because Ryan Coonerty and Mayor Riley and Police Chief Scary somehow think that's a good idea. I don't go for that. And I hope you don't either. It's too bad that more people haven't resisted this in a way that said, good, give us some tickets. Let's get some citations. Let's take this matter to court. Do whatever you want with it. We're not going to obey it. We're going to continue to live our lives as before without surrendering and becoming and adopting, internalizing a little police officer inside our head to say, oh, no, you can't walk through the parking garage. You can't go there. You can't go into that parking garage unless you have a car. You can't stop here and talk. Don't sit down and read a book here. You know, don't sit down and pull out your laptop and try to work on some problem. You know, don't take someone aside here and have a conversation here. Don't come in out of the rain here anymore. This is all what's involved with this law. And the expansion of this law means that what had the previous is going to spread all over the city to all the 19 parking lots. I'm going to continue now, having given my little tirade. Back to the downtown commission.
So if you have any specific questions about the crimes, I'm happy to answer them.
Two things. One is, do you have a sense if this has...
This is Sheila Coonerty talking, who was on the board of directors of the American Civil Liberties Union, who I don't know what position they've taken on this parking lot law. And last year they voted against it, and they asked that it not be. And they sent Don Zimmerman, who was in the audience this year, too. Sheila Coonerty here is the only person who ultimately voted against this law when it reached a final passage vote at the end of the downtown commission meeting last Thursday.
Kind of numbers have increased in the last year or so. Did you look backwards to see if there's any change? No, I didn't look back at any kind of historical data. I mean, quite frankly, when you look at crime data over the last, say, 10 years, it's gone through peaks and valleys, but I think statistically speaking, it's pretty easy to draw a line through it, say that there hasn't been any significant criminal increase at all. I mean, some crimes have gone up. We saw significant increase, for example, in the last few years of sexual assaults, and then they dropped off significantly last year. But it doesn't really make any sense to say when things go up for 2 years and then go down for 1 year. I mean, which year do you choose to acknowledge? I mean, when you look at it over a longer horizon, you find that statistically speaking, crime has been relatively consistent. Calls for service have gone up slightly over the last 5 years. That actually, which is interesting to know, that our department has decreased in size by 15% over the last 5 years. And obviously officers initiate a lot of their own activity. So when you see that calls for service and arrests are relatively consistent with 15% less, you can probably say that there's been some sort of slight increase, but when you just look at the numbers purely, they look consistent.
And the second question is...
And the point of the first question that Sheila Coonerty had was... We passed a law a year ago, or we passed a recommendation, and the city council then passed it, actually somewhat against their recommendation. It was a mixed recommendation. That what's happened a year later? Has the crime rate dropped? Has it increased? And Zach Friend, instead of answering that question directly, whereby you could judge, well, it might be related to the law, it might not, we can argue it either way, he went off into a little rift that had nothing to do with Sheila Coonerty's question. I mean, you also got to ask, as I said before, what's the crime rate outside the parking garages and lots in other parts of town in terms of the, compared to the crime rate in the parking lots and garages, if you want to come to an understanding of the issue in a fair and objective way. She just wanted to know, we passed this parking garage law, removing it from the public space for people, generally speaking, unless they're parking a car or bicycle. How has that affected the crime rate? And his answer was, oh, we don't have those statistics. Now, before, the downtown commission said, you don't have these statistics, well, we're not going to give you a new law unless you give us statistics. Well, this time they caved, even though they got the same answer. Of course, this answer was with respect to the parking garages, which has to do with how effective the past law has been, but it's relevant to making a decision as to whether you want to expand this law to the lots.
One of the arguments last time we talked about this was that police needed this tool because they were otherwise unable to arrest people for drug possession, etc. And yet you seem to be. So I'm wondering, is it that if you showed us all the calls, that there would be a large majority of calls where the police weren't able to do something?
Well, we received 75,000 calls for service and made about 16,000 actionable, say, be it arrests or whatever it may be during the year. Obviously, the vast majority of calls that we go to, nothing per se is done, but a police officer's time is taken to do something. I'm sure as some of you work downtown in businesses or own downtown businesses, you may call us and say you just saw something happen. By the time we get there, the person's gone. I mean, that goes to the calls for service. It's obviously an officer is tied up doing that. They couldn't be doing something else, but there's no documented items. So then, if I'm understanding your question correctly, then yes, there's a lot more calls than there actually are items that show some sort of action.
Well, what I'm trying to get at is whether one of the things that made me stop and think last time was that perhaps there was no other way that police could manage the drug problem in the town. And yet it seems like they are doing arrests for drugs. So I'm trying to figure out, I can understand the idea that when, you know, they're calling them not there anymore, that would be true even if their ordinance was good. But if there's a sense that there are people who have hidden, you know, that is there any data or is there any way that you could tell me by looking at the data whether there are people who have, that you could have dealt with were an ordinance in place.
Now, this recording is not the best, and hopefully by Sunday when I come back, the show returns 9:30 in the Sunday morning, I'll have the actual official tape, and I'll be able to play it, and you'll be able to get a better listen to what's going on. But again, you have the question that's being asked here is, well, you say you have stats for drug arrests in the parking lots, and you say yet you need a new tool. That's one of the arguments the police used. We need a new tool to challenge people who are in the parking lot so we can do drug arrests and other kinds of behavior. And yet, at the same time, they're showing us stats that indicate existing drug arrests. So she's saying, what's the answer to this? And she's getting what sounds to be like non-responsive responses from Zach Friend of the police department. I mean, I can imagine what might be a responsive response. You know, I can imagine saying something like, well, there would be less drug activity because people would be afraid to even go in there because they would know it's illegal, and therefore it would be a useful tool in the sense that it would make that area drug free even though it would drive it somewhere else. And that in fact became a concern of some groups, some people who talked about it later on the commission, which is only to be driving people, driving it into different areas, obviously. I mean, that's what happens. And, you know, it has actually no relation to eliminating drug use. It eliminates all public use. So, yeah, it'll probably cut down on drug use, too, if you're concerned about drug use, as though that were an issue that really we should be deeply, deeply concerned about in terms of criminal law, which is, of course, the war on terrorism bullshit that we're getting locally. It's kind of the local war on terrorism stuff is the war on drugs. Instead of real solutions to the problem, we get people calling for more power for the police department. But the question here is specifically, what about this particular power? Well, Zach Friend doesn't give us any indication of how this tool would help out, given the fact that his own statistics show they're already making these kinds of arrests in the parking lot. So it's not going to really provide them with a new tool to say, hey, you in the parking lot, where's your car or vehicle? You've been here for 16 minutes, even if you got a car. Now we can come up to you and get all your drug paraphernalia, even though we didn't see you doing anything druggy. Because if you see somebody doing something that's illegal, at the present time, as we can see from these stats, you can move on them.
That seems to be the belief with the inaction of what happened in the garage, is that there provides a point of contact. If somebody is there for an extended period of time, it provides the officer a reason to contact somebody. This is no different from, for example, some of the discussions recently that happened on Halloween. People, when they have a point of contact with the police officer, be it via criminal intelligence for whatever reason it may be, that somebody may be doing something illicit downtown, say on Halloween, once you have contact with an officer, you're much less likely to commit a crime very soon after that point. It's a preventative measure. So we believe that the ordinance allowed that. You can never measure how many crimes were prevented. I mean, and realistically, you never hear about the crimes that are prevented, and the department doesn't exactly get a whole lot of credit for crimes that don't happen. All you ever hear about are things that actually happened. So
the argument is, we're going to stop crime in the parking lots because we'll be giving us a tool, to wit, you can't be in the parking lot, therefore we can contact you, that we didn't have before. In point of fact, police have the opportunity to contact people at any time for any reason. Doesn't mean a person has to respond, but they have a right to contact you. I mean, just like you have a right to contact them. Everybody has a right to contact anybody else. So Zach's argument seems to me to be, shallow, superficial, unresponsive. I don't know. I guess what he means is we have an opportunity to compel you to talk to us if you're under suspicion of a crime. The new crime being being in a public space that previously had been not only legal but a positive benefit to the community and part of our heritage here in Santa Cruz. No, now it becomes a tool for the police to contact you. I mean, this is the shriveling of not just the Constitution but the whole Santa Cruz ethic in order to serve the police department's aims, which, you know, I'm not saying their aims are necessarily bad, but they're only a part of a larger community of aims. And when we put these police priorities as the primary aims, particularly in such bogus nonsense as the drug war, we are doing ourselves a tremendous disservice. And we're also doing a disservice to the police department, because police do have, in some respects, a legitimate function, although I find myself yearning for other models.
It would be statistically impossible, and it's something that the department is always, is a charge that's always sort of leveled against the agency, which is, how do we know what works and how do we know what doesn't work? But realistically, no one can prove what prevents and what doesn't prevent crime or how many have been prevented. All you can do is take what the officers believe, that this provides a point of contact that helps prevent crime.
Well, you could do things like look at the real stats about the dropping crime rate before and after, let's say, you instituted the law. Unfortunately, the very figures that they provide for the lot number 9, where the law was suddenly instituted last summer, went into force actually last winter, passed last summer, went into effect last winter, they don't break down the statistics. So you don't get to see if there was any change in criminal activity, quote unquote, where, again, we're talking about such dastardly crimes as drug sales and possession warrants, and I guess vehicle burglary, 6 instances of vehicle burglary in 18 months. You could see if you had a record, you get some more indication. So Zach's comments are, should I say, horse shit? I mean, I don't know what to say. I tend to get a little too, impassioned about it, but, well, you be the judge.
Any questions?
I'm looking this over. I noticed the preponderance of alcohol-related in the warrant.
This is Joe of Atlantis Fantasy World, Commissioner, asking a question.
Health violations. But I was curious, what is a criminal field interview that actually results in a psychic action? How do you characterize that? Now, the criminal field interview is not an actual citation or an arrest. It's a contact by a police officer with an individual where information is gathered from that individual. I see.
And the reason he asks this question is, in only one parking lot are statistics given for criminal field interviews. The Cedar and Elm Street parking lot number 9, that is the one where it became illegal to go in there. The one where homeless people are likely to go in because it's right across from where they're eating. And it's on an area where it's the largest bit of open public space there. No longer public, of course, at least not for those of us who don't have cars or bikes, and even those, then only for 15 minutes. But they conducted criminal field interviews, and it's not terribly clear what they're talking about, except the law became a pretext for stopping people and engaging in criminal field interviews with them. Actually, get it clear, if a police officer stops you, you don't have to say a damn thing. You really don't. That they may still arrest you if you're engaging in criminal behavior or just to harass you, although that would put them at some legal risk in theory if you wanted to run around and find an attorney or take them to small claims court. But in fact, it's strange that, well, it's not really strange. It's actually quite understandable. You give the police more powers and they use them. Hence, there are lots of criminal field interviews in this parking lot because they've been given more powers to use them. And they now have the power to question a lot of people about stuff because they say, well, you're in the parking lot. You're here illegally. And instead of a person saying, good, well, ticket me and I'll be on my way, which is what they should do, homeless people don't want to get into that kind of shit. And so they're willing to posture and play and talk and, you know, and snitch out and do what is necessary to get the police officers off their back. And it's something that I think we all understand. But to claim that it is a positive thing, I don't know. I suppose it provides information for solving other crimes in theory. But the idea that you eliminate people's rights and you grill them and you make areas of the previously open to the community inaccessible in order to give yourself a tool to grill them more doesn't sit well with me.
In Lot 9, you're using that to document the warnings. Lot 9 is the one lot that we currently have that ordinance in place. We wanted to show how many warnings were given in this situation. That's why you'll see that there's 40. So these were warnings rather than citations. That is correct. Okay, I got it.
My question was just how you selected which lots were reported on, whether it was a random sampling or you chose them based on size of lot or number of parking spaces or what. Some that might argue against this ordinance might say that you're showing the five worst things to try to scare them into taking some action. So I'd like to know what your selection process was for this information.
Well, actually, I wish it was as intelligent as you had just said that. Quite frankly, the lots 23 and 27 were the lots that had come up in your last discussion. The front Laurel lot is why you used that one. The ones that at Cedar and Lincoln were the lots next to the farmer's market, which is always sort of a point of discussion. This was just thoughts of lots I thought would show you a sampling. It wasn't any kind of... It was just a sampling.
Jack, I have a question.
So, in other words, though the police have had many, many months to come up with a relatively complete listing of crimes in all the lots, 19 lots, they've only come up with the crimes in actually 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 of them. Let me see if I got that right. Yeah, because two of them are combined, 23, no, 6 of them. Lot 4 at Cathcart and Cedar, Lot 8 at Cedar and Lincoln. Front and Laurel, lots 23 and 27. And Front and Cathcart, lot 7. And Cedar and Elm, lot 9. They had the opportunity to come up with everything because, you know, they're... Well, they may have had a reduced force of down to, you know, 15% less. They still have... I don't know. I can't speak authoritatively. But it seems to me that if they are pushing this new law, their responsibility is to come up with statistics to show it. And, of course... When I saw that they brought nothing at the last meeting, I guess, you know, that maybe they felt this time they had to do a little something to, instead of bringing adequate statistics, they brought the police brass and the merchants. That's, in essence, what happened at the Downtown Commission. More from them.
I want to say that I appreciate how difficult it is to quantify and document prevention. I think
Julie Shattuck, the
drug and alcohol
chair of the Downtown
Commission. Development, many other fields really struggle with trying to document the value of prevention activities. If you prevent something, it's very difficult to be able to explain what that was. So I appreciate that, and I appreciate the challenges that you have. One of the questions I have is, what categories of crimes do you anticipate this particular tool would help address?
It'd be speculation. What we'd have to assume is that anything that's in the top crime types, things that also involve people that just need a little bit more time, such as drug sales and thefts, which are things that happen quickly, but people tend to be in the lots for a little bit of time before they actually occur. But it's very, very difficult to know, since physical crimes are really crimes of opportunity, whether or not, meaning assaults with deadly weapons, or what that would exactly do. And it would be disingenuous of me to say that this ordinance is going to prevent all serious crime in the parking lots.
Of course, he's not talking about anything, really. He was asked, you know, what crimes do you think this is going to assist you in dealing with? And really what's being proposed here is the idea that it's a kind of a hurry-up law, no loitering law. Prove yourself law, which cuts down on the amount of public space which people are allowed to linger in and group in. And the theory here is that there's more grouping for criminal behavior than there is for innocent behavior or productive behavior, although there's no evidence at all is being presented on this issue, and that the social value that we lose in losing all these public spaces is counterbalanced by the safety we're going to get by not having people there, assuming, again, that this is going to be made safer, which is, again, a second issue. But the question was relatively simple. What crimes are actually going to be cut down by this? And if he had a real answer, he would say so. Well, he did sort of say, well, there's drugs, less opportunity. When people want to commit a crime, they will go to where they need to do it to commit the crime. I mean, and, you know, I suppose if you remove the parking lots and make it more, put it under more observation, people are less likely to do it there. I'll agree with that. I'll grant that argument. The question, though, is what about everything else? And is it worth it? And exactly, and this is the reason he doesn't answer the question, in my view, how preponderant is that crime that we want to abandon all the positive things in favor of eliminating that negative thing? In order to know that answer to that question, we have to have some really clear stats on that. How prevalent is that crime in the lot? How compared with other places? Has it been going up or down? Did the previous law, when it was put into effect in Lot 9, have a good impact on this? None of these questions are answerable because they don't give us any stats, which leads me to believe a couple of things. First, that they're being deliberately deceptive, which I don't think they are. I think they just think, we have so much power. You know, if we can intimidate the city council into denouncing Tony Madrigal, well, we can do whatever the hell we want. You know, if we can, you know, we don't have to worry about bringing in the stats. All we got to do is bring in the merchants and show a couple of badges, you know, in the audience. Because there has been really no significant increase in information here. Other than, and this is really what the Downtown Commission said at the end of this whole thing, well, all these merchants came in and they expressed all their concerns and their belief it would be a good idea. And I guess we'll just have to go along with that. Even though there was no hard evidence that any of this was going to be positive, was needed, overweighed the unintended consequences or negative stuff. Those words, unintended consequences, I don't think even came out in this hearing, even though that is really what this is all about, what my discussion here at Free Radio is all about. There are unintended consequences in passing this law. And they are many, and they are immense. And they range from, you know, hanging out with your kids in a place where, you know, you feel more comfortable rather than, say, trying to... The sidewalk is smaller. You may not have the money to go into a store. Yeah, there are parks that are around. But, you know, you may not want to walk all the way over to a park. Downtown, there's no plaza. The nearest park is San Lorenzo Park, or I guess you can go all the way up to Loudon Nelson Park. The Scribner Park is in the process of being sold off, if it hasn't already happened. So, places where you would engage in all kinds of ordinary activity are going to be eaten up come Tuesday, unless we do something.
This wouldn't be an accurate statement. I really just don't know.
Okay. But what I heard you say is that once you have contacts, people tend to be less prone to commit crimes.
That's correct, which is why I'm assuming that the top four crime types would be the top four reductions that you would see in these laws, because that's the only statistical thing I could assume.
Okay. Jerry?
So in Lot 9, where you have the 40 warnings that were issued in that 8 months period, if you subtract, so we should really subtract the 40 from the 114 to get a comparison of the lot that you're showing us, right?
Right, that's done in the staff report.
So that gives us a number of 74. And I'd like you to talk about how the ordinance is working in Lot 9 and what changes you've noticed there. Somebody.
I'm going to ask the downtown, the former downtown lieutenant, if you'd speak to that specifically, Lieutenant Escalante. Is that okay?
Good morning, Commission. Rudy Escalante, Lieutenant Police Department. Can you rephrase or repeat your question again?
This ordinance has been in effect in Lot 9. It's the one service Lutford has been in effect for how long? Over a year now?
Yes.
So it might be really helpful for us to hear how, I mean, this is a perfect example of what might happen in the other laws just if the ordinance were extended. So could you just give us a picture of what it was like before, how the ordinance has helped, what it's like now, how it's different?
From my experience, there was a lot of problems in that lot, specifically in areas where people would, around the tree there, the one at Cedar now. From drug sales to vandalism to loitering, the minors in possession, all kinds of alcohol violations, physical assaults, more serious crimes, vandalisms, the break-ins, the trash. We had a lot of problems in there, public nuisance type activity that we were getting in, that was prior to. After that, some of that activity still occurred, but it was much less than it was before.
So is there signage in the lot, and that's part of what's making it work, or is it actual contact with the police making it work?
We use whatever we can to try and deter that type of activity, whether it's increased lighting, whether it's signage, identifying parking issues, landscape issues, whatever we can.
Now, again, you don't have the figures before you, but again, go to indiebay.org/Santa Cruz and look for the story on the downtown parking lots on the extreme right of the screen. If you're listening to this later or if you're listening to it now and you have access to a computer, what you do when you what you see when you examine the report is that for the last year and a half, all crimes, there have been a total of no more than 74 arrests and citations in 18 months. The biggest number of these was for drug sales and possession. The next was for warrants, which means people were stopped for a warrant, probably based upon the law. Oh, you're walking in the parking lot, or just people are intimidated into acknowledging who they are, and you don't have to say that to a police officer. You actually, you know, it may be wisest to identify yourself if you're under arrest, because they can hold you until they can identify you, but technically you're not required to. I choose to remain silent, officer. I'm not trying to be difficult, but that's my right, and I'm accepting it. You can say that if you want. And it's not a bad thing to do. The stats on that lot number 9 she's talking about, we have no way of knowing what went down, and one would think that if she were really interested in, she wouldn't ask for Lieutenant Escalante's offhand opinion, because obviously he supports this law. Of course, the reason she does is because she supports it, too. She's one of the most conservative members of this board. She's been pushing for this law for a year and a half, and now she's got it. At least she's got it past the downtown commission, Jerry Mandel, on the downtown commission. And what she would demand if she were willing to try to make a persuasive argument that wasn't just asking for Lieutenant Escalante's opinion. Obviously, he favors the law. I wouldn't be there supporting it if he didn't. But, you know, what are the stats that show that there's a crimes have dropped or have changed after the, you know, after the law was passed in the summer of 2006? And if you look at this, it doesn't look like this was much of a criminal problem anyway. And again, we can't see because we don't have any comparison with any of the stats anywhere else in town. And that's something that the Downtown Commission just doesn't seem to want to ask. And even when they do ask kind of questions that approach the, what happened before and what happened after, they get anecdotal information and opinion from the police department that doesn't give you any specific facts. 6 vehicle burglaries in a total of 18 months in that lot is the basis for excluding everybody from that lot, unless they're parking a car or vehicle, and then hurrying them along. Doesn't seem appropriate.
But, I mean, once the ordinance was put in place, the sign went up, is that right?
Yes, and there was increased or decreased amount of activity that was happening before.
Just putting a sign up made a difference?
No. Not just the sign, no.
We also have, you know, assistance from parking control staff, parking maintenance staff, to advise people that not to loiter, you know, et cetera, about the ordinance. So it's not just a function of what the police department does, but it's also a function of what the public works staff and parking control to let people know that to have the ordinances in place and how to use the parking lot.
And that's what I meant by cleaning up the landscape and the lighting. We work with Parks and Rec and Public Works to help deter all those activities.
Does anybody know if the people that were approached to educate them about the new policy, were they upset? Did they complain?
Jerry, I've had some discussions on that very question, and I was told that the majority of the contacts were not met with any hostility at all, that they were actually thankful to get informed about what it was all about afterwards.
And that's in our...
I don't know whether to be depressed or shake my head at this. You know, people went along like good sheep when told to move off the area. I mean, who doesn't when a police officer tells you that? Most people don't want to object. And to have, it's kind of interesting. This is Joe of Atlantis Fantasy World, who what does he do? He sings the national anthem at one of these large sports events every year. He runs a comic book store and talks about the importance of civil liberties for people. He was a big supporter of the V for Vendetta movie, which talked about, you know, it was an extreme statement of civil rights a year ago, civil liberties. And to hear him saying this kind of thing is depressing to me, because it shows he values his role as a merchant and the merchant community is more important to him than his principles as a civil libertarian. You know, it's just, it's sad. And it tends to reinforce my merchant stereotypes, unfortunately. Although the last time we did this, a week ago, I had in the studio a badass coffee owner, that's the name of a coffee shop downtown, who actually opposes this law. And he was the only merchant I know who said that they do. I should also point out that the Downtown Association, which discussed this issue a year ago and actually let Huff make a presentation, although then they shooed us out when they had their secret discussions, didn't let us know about their meeting that was coming up to discuss this issue, though perhaps we should have known and anticipated it. And we weren't really on the inside to see I understand there was spirited discussion at the Downtown Association meeting. That's the merchant group that is sort of steered around by Keith Holtaway. I don't know if it's steered around. He's the executive director. The Downtown Commission, on the other hand, is a city body appointed by the city council, which these laws are supposed to be run through before they get dumped on us.
Experience too with the Park and Control staff, as far as they felt really that it has made their job easier. It's an opportunity to make contact and also to warn people. As noted in the staff report, only two citations have been issued during this time period. So it's not being used as a heavy-handed tool. It's being used as a warning. And people seem to, appreciate being told what the rules are.
As the downtown commander, when this ordinance was enacted, I had not received any phone calls or complaints regarding it.
So call the downtown commander, Lieutenant Escalante, and let him know you don't much like this law. He hasn't received any complaints. And this is another thing. It seems like the commission is smoothing the way for this law. Haven't received any complaints, have you? Everything's okay. People don't mind. Let's roll forward with it.
Are the lights patrolled on a regular basis during the day and the evening?
They're regularly patrolled during the day. There's not a regular set schedule as to when they're patrolled, but that's part of the patrol assignment in the downtown area.
And why not in the evenings?
In the evenings as well.
In the evenings as well?
No, during the officer's shifts.
Okay, so each shift they're...
Yes.
Mm-hmm. I have a question. What do you anticipate would be the likely inconveniences and issues with enforcing the ordinance? Obviously, this is going to sweep up some folks involved in legal activities, having lunch on the sidewalk, traversing, visiting with friends in the lots. So what do you anticipate will be the inconvenient scenarios that the public might have to deal with if this is enforced?
The way it's set up, it's actually designed to avoid those inconveniences by at least warning people. It gives them the opportunity to at least be made aware of it. So as far as any other inconveniences, there's not any others that I can think of right now.
You know, this reminds me of something that was chalked on the sidewalk right outside the Berkeley volleyball court controversy when the University of California and the Berkeley city government were trying to essentially pave over large parts of People's Park because they didn't want it really to be open to the public in the same way it was. They wanted to change the quality and character of it. They wanted to become a sports area for certain university activities. And Christopher McKinney wrote on the sidewalk in erasable chalk, "A police state is more expensive than a welfare state. We guarantee it." And he was arrested for chalking on the sidewalk. The arrest was dismissed, and he successfully sued for $25,000 because he was arrested for essentially First Amendment activity. Santa Cruz has reversed that equation when Becky Johnson was arrested for chalking on the sidewalk, but a sleeping ban law is against basic human rights. Actually, it was something along those lines. She was arrested, held in jail on high bail, finally released, had a trial, and the judge ruled that this was vandalism, even though it was exactly the same kind of erasable chalk. That happened 7 years, 8 years later, I believe. Actually, no, it was more like 10 years later. She was arrested in 2002, and McKinney was arrested in 1992, I believe. But the point is, unless the community that cares about these issues makes it a more expensive activity, the police and the merchants and the conservative staff on city council will change the quality of the downtown. They will make it a different place. They are already doing that, unless we say no. Call in if you have any points or questions you want to make, 427-3772. We have about 15 minutes left in the show. I'm going to play another 5 minutes of this, and then I'll continue it on Sunday, for those of you who want to hear it, and probably start it early on Thomas Levitt's show, The Wake-Up Call, if he's amenable. We'll see if he's up for that. That'll be starting probably as early as 7:30, maybe 8:30 in the morning. My show actually officially begins at 9:30.
I just have a question about the practicality of manpower. I mean, you're creating a new ordinance, and you've got apparently now many more people to make contact with related to this ordinance, and we're already hearing that the size of your force has shrunk by 15% over the last 5 years. How do you enforce this then with the limited manpower that you have?
Most of the officers are extremely diligent in how to manage their time. And where areas are of a concern where we start to see spikes of problems, then they address those issues in those areas. So they're able to really adapt fairly well to those issues, and they are able to move around to the problem areas that are needed.
You know, I think the issue is it takes less staff time to be proactive and provide warnings than it does to deal with an incident. So in a way, this makes it, you know, more efficient for the police department. And it also gives parking control and parking maintenance an opportunity to help in that regard.
It would be interesting if they actually had some stats about the amount of police time spent on parking lot number 9 after this ordinance was put into place, as distinguished from before. But, of course, they have no such stats, nor do they have any stats about the amount of time police have spent with respect to the parking garages, nor do they have where this law has been enforced for the last year, nor even, as I've mentioned before, as to the number of arrests in the parking garages, whether they've gone up, down, or sideways. We got no information on them, which was actually required by the city council as part of a six-month report. No such report. And the downtown commission noticed this lack of a report last time and said, let's have it. And the police department still didn't give it. You know, this kind of intransigence on the part of the police department, or this kind of bland refusal to deal with the most elementary kinds of considerations that they were required to do by the city council, not only shows us who's running the city, but kind of is chilling in that it means that this police department has no obligation to really do anything other than politically pressure the city council and the various advisory bodies to pass their agenda. This is on the police department agenda. This is a police tool that they want. And it's also, admittedly, on the Coonerty, Robinson, Matthews agenda. Those are the three council members who sit in secret on the Downtown Improvement Task Force, which sent this law to the downtown commission or urged it be passed, along with one of the little neighborhood fascisti groups that gets together, kind of the vigilante gangs that do the community watches in very close coordination with the police department. I use this kind of language because this is the impression I have that these groups have toward poor people, homeless people, people of color, yeah, even that. And I'm wondering why we aren't doing something on our side, so to speak, to mobilize and raise issues that will, raise some kind of solidarity against it. I mean, they're saying, see, we took away all their rights in the garages and nobody gave a shit, so why not just take away all their rights in the parking lot? Let's have them behave like a bunch of good consumers, park their cars and bicycles, and see, they'll behave, they won't complain. You know, and the police department doesn't have to make any statistical arguments that show a decrease in crime or, you know, answer questions about what about the fact that your police department has supposedly dropped by 15%. You know, are you going to have the person power to do that? How much time are you spending enforcing this? They don't have to answer those questions because they know this is going to be passed anyway.
So, you know, we really kind of have, you know, expanded a little bit. Makes it better for everybody, I think. The areas that, I think we have to keep in mind is we're trying to make it work better for everyone and less intimidating for people who come to the downtown, whether they're a visitor from out of town, whether they're a resident living on the east side to come downtown to do their shopping or go to a restaurant. So if the parking lot can be safer, can less opportunity for people just hanging out, then people will use them. And
there it is, right there. People hanging out. That's the crime they're trying to eliminate. Of course, it isn't a crime, but they're making it a crime. And that's the point. The downtown that Chris Schneider, who I believe was the person speaking, is a part of the Public Works Department, and Lieutenant Escalante, and Officer Zach Friend, and Councilmember Ryan Coonerty want, is a town where people aren't engaged in that kind of hanging out. But, of course, this is a direct violation of the traditions and the natural habits of a significant number of people who live in Santa Cruz. It's an attempt to change that. Now, people who have fancy houses, more wealth, or who are peons rushing to work and back before they return to their subterranean dwellings way out of town, maybe may not, you know, have the time or leisure to do this or the inclination to do this or... they may not feel sufficiently courageous to do this because, you know, they don't want to... Dealing with a citation for somebody who's got two jobs is a real pain in the ass. I mean, you know, you have to worry about that kind of stuff. So what we have here are police state measures eliminating public space. And what's the reason? To eliminate people hanging out. Safety? Their business. There's no indication of any change in safety. Even Zach Friend admitted the crime rate is flat. So this is all being done as part of a lifestyle cultural change. That's what they're looking for downtown, and that's what's being pressed. And that's what has to be fought unless we want to accede to it.
You know, they'll use different ones instead of focusing on saying, oh, no, that parking lot's overstayed or people aren't hanging out in the little park over there. And so I think there's really an opportunity for everyone here to make the situation better and to do it in a manner that's not heavy-handed. You know, we're really not, you know, here to do citations. That's really, I think, pretty admirable.
And this tape is going to continue on Sunday, hopefully a better version of it. I'm going to do a little reading now from something that interested me and that I'm going to also be discussing on Sunday. It's called How Nonviolence Protects the State. And it's by a guy called Peter Gelderloos. It's a book published, how long ago? South End Press, this year, I guess, the current edition. I could spend plenty of time talking about the failures of nonviolence. Instead, it may be more useful to talk about the successes of nonviolence. Pacifism would hardly be attractive to its supporters if the ideology had produced no historical victories. Typical examples are the independence of India from British colonial rule, caps on the nuclear arms race, the civil rights movement of the 1960s, and the peace movement during the war against Vietnam. And though they have not yet been hailed as a victory, the massive protests in 2003 against the U.S. invasion of Iraq have been much applauded by nonviolent activists. There is a pattern to the historical manipulation and whitewashing evident in every single victory claimed by nonviolent activists. The pacifist position requires that success must be attributable to pacifist tactics and pacifist tactics alone, whereas the rest of us believe that change comes from the whole spectrum of tactics present in any revolutionary situation, provided they are deployed effectively. Because no major social conflict exhibits a uniformity of tactics and ideologies, which is to say that all such conflict exhibit pacifist tactics and decidedly non-pacifist tactics, pacifists have to erase the history that disagrees with them or alternately blame their failures on the contemporary presence of violent struggle. In India, the story goes, people under the leadership of Gandhi built up a massive nonviolent movement over decades and engaged in protest, non-cooperation, economic boycotts, and exemplary hunger strikes and acts of disobedience to make British imperialism unworkable. They suffered massacres and responded with a couple of riots, but on the whole, the movement was nonviolent, and after persevering for decades, the Indian people won their independence, providing an undeniable hallmark of pacifist victory. The actual history is more complicated in that many violent pressures also informed the British decision to withdraw. The British had lost the ability to maintain colonial power after losing millions of troops and a great deal of other resources during two extremely violent world wars, the second of which especially devastated the mother country. The armed struggles of Arab and Jewish militants in Palestine from 1945 to 1948 further weakened the British Empire and presented a clear threat that the Indians might give up civil disobedience and take up arms en masse if ignored for long enough. This cannot be excluded as a factor in the decision of the British to relinquish direct colonial administration. We realize this threat to be even more direct when we understand that the pacifist history of India's independence movement is a selective and incomplete picture. Nonviolence was not universal in India. Resistance to British colonialism included enough militancy that the Gandhian method can be viewed more accurately as one of several competing forms of popular resistance. As part of a disturbingly universal pattern, pacifists white out these other forms of resistance and help propagate the false theory that Gandhi and his disciples were the lone masthead and rudder of Indian resistance. Ignored are important militant leaders such as Chandrasekhar Azad, who fought an armed struggle against the British colonizers, and revolutionaries such as Bhagat Singh, who won mass support for bombings and assassinations as part of a struggle to accomplish the overthrow of both foreign and Indian capitalism. The pacifist history of India's struggle cannot make any sense of the fact that Subhas Chandra Bose, the militant candidate, was twice elected president of the Indian National Congress in 1938 and 1939, while Gandhi was perhaps the most singularly influential and popular figure in India's independence struggle. The leadership position he assumed did not always enjoy the consistent backing of the masses. Gandhi lost so much support from Indians when he called off the movement after the 1922 riot that when the British locked him up afterwards, not a ripple of protest arose in India at his arrest. Significantly, history remembers Gandhi above all others not because he represented the unanimous voice of India, but because of all the attention he was given by the British press and the prominence he received from being included in important negotiations with the British colonial government. When we remember that history is written by the victors, another layer of the myth of Indian independence comes unraveled. The sorriest aspect of pacifists' claim that the independence of India is a victory for nonviolence is that this claim plays directly into the historical fabrication carried out in the interests of the white supremacist imperialist states that colonized the global South. The liberation movement in India failed. The British were not forced to quit India. Rather, they chose to transfer the territory from direct colonial rule to neo-colonial rule. What kind of victory allows the losing side to dictate the time and manner of the victor's ascendancy? The British authored the new constitution and turned power over to hand-picked successors. They fanned the flames of religious and ethnic separation so that India would be divided against itself, prevented from gaining peace and prosperity, and dependent on military aid and other support from Euro-American states. India is still exploited by Euro-American corporations, though several new Indian corporations, mostly subsidiaries, have joined in the pillaging and still provides resources and markets for imperial states. Anyway, this is called How Nonviolence Protects the State by Peter Gelderloos, And why do I read it? Well, because I think we need to consider, I'm not suggesting mass violent tactics in Santa Cruz, but I'm suggesting we have to consider all kinds of avenues for change, and that we have to understand history truly, not just how some people would like to regard it. I also want to say a word about Grinmaster Greg. He's the musician who has been a mainstay of the Wednesday Night Safe Society for Artistic Freedom and Expression shindigs in front of the bookshop Santa Cruz. I'm sorry, in front of the, I got my mind on the bookshop Santa Cruz, in front of the New Leaf Market. Greg has developed cancer, serious cancer, and he is in Dominican Hospital. For those who want to contact him, give him a call, a Dominican. He's in room 2501, and his family is with him, so you can call him. Don't worry. They'll screen the calls in case, you know, you're afraid you might reach him at a bad time. He is seriously, seriously ill, and he may not have long to live. I just want to bring that out in this rather somber scene that we've had tonight. And I'll be coming back on Sunday, and that's pretty much all I've got for tonight. I thank you for being with me on this edition of Bathurst Spears Broadsides, and for the many phone calls that you sent in. Hopefully somebody's listening out there. And again, the show is archived on the Huff website, huffsantacruz.org. If you want to reach me off air, you can give me a call at 423-HUFF, 423-4833. I'll be trying to do updates on Fresno, where there's a lot happening on Sunday. Continue doing some more of the Downtown Commission's analysis, or I should say lack of analysis, and I'll see you then. Or actually, maybe you'll hear me then. Thanks for being with me on this edition of Bathrop's Pier's Broadsides. And before I leave you entirely, let me go out on the music of Mike True. Coming up next, Uncle Dennis's From the Cream to the Dregs.
Girl, starting over one more time. Hung some pictures on the wall. She wants to make her cottage shine. Sequined outfit closet hung, bought herself a bed and chair. Then the man on the radio said, "You gotta get away from there." Hard to leave. station. She didn't want to go. Emancipation, that was on her list. A lonely motel room in Memphis. She never dreamt of this. The food, the music, living late on the roulette. Would her world be washed away? All those people losing everything. And safe, just a little misplaced in his heart. And now, baby, get into my big black car. And now, baby, get into
And welcome to From the Cream to the Dregs here on Free Radio Santa Cruz. Uncle Dennis inheriting the slightly warm and always very interesting chair left by our friend Robert Norris. Anyway, Robert will be back on Sunday with more news of the folk of the street. So do tune in on Sunday for more Robert Norris. Anyway, I said it was Uncle Dennis. I said this is From the Cream to the Dregs. We just heard some Cream, and I don't know, why not hear some more?
Time someone knows.